There is an expression whose origins have been lost to the mists of time that says, "May you live in interesting times." At first glance, this appears to be a nice thing to say, but in fact, it is the opposite. It is a curse of sorts. Times that are interesting mean that nothing is common, quiet, or predictable. It means that people must stay on their toes, stay vigilant, and be constantly on guard against threats, known and unknown. 2025 is the halfway point of an already tumultuous decade. So what do you think the next 12 months will have in store for us? I'm sure it will be nothing short of interesting. I'm Steve Prentice, and this is the Talos Security Sessions podcast. To help us part the veil and peer into the year that represents the middle of this decade, it is my great pleasure to sit down by a virtual fireplace and chat with David Holmes, who is Chief Technology Officer for Application Security at Imperva, a Talos company. David, welcome to the Talos Security Sessions podcast.
Hey, thanks. I'm super honored to be here.
We have had a busy year. All years are busy, of course. There's all kinds of ups and downs and developments and changes. So before we start looking into the future, your sort of visions for 2025, I just wanted to ask you what you thought of 2024. You know, what surprised you the most about our industry in this past 12 months?
From a cybersecurity perspective, I think a story that maybe got buried because I think it came out right around the elections and in the US, that just was like, it was like a rainstorm of news drowning everything out. But it was the whole SALT typhoon threat actor who may have compromised many global networks, including telecom networks, and leading to one government agency, I think it might have been CISA, recommending or at least thinking about, hey, maybe everybody should switch to end-to-end encryption. The reason I think it's so significant is it's terrifying how much data third parties that we all trust have on us. And if there's a threat actor in the middle there who could be intercepting all this information, that's just awful. So let me tell you about a thought experiment I used to do years ago, which I think is still valid today. Try to think of which companies know about every extramarital affair in the world. And it's like, well, probably Apple, probably Google, basically anybody who has the exact GPS coordinates of phones and knows the identities, right? Because they could go, well, these two phones are always in the same hotel room, but we know they aren't married, or we know they're married to somebody else. And amazingly, that information has never leaked that we know of, right? And that's good. But what if a threat actor had access to that information? Think of all the mischief that could happen, even if they only just used it to sort of preload their own spies to begin compromising individuals in the right places. That could absolutely happen. So it sort of made the news, and then I think the general public didn't really pay much attention to it because nobody came to ask me, what is end-to-end encryption? So anyway, that was the one. And I'm keeping my eye on it, seeing how that's going.
Yeah, you're totally right. And it continues to unfold, especially with senior people at CISA and also various legislators within the U.S. governmental system, basically saying, well, we're not quite sure the extent of this. It sounds a lot like SolarWinds and some of the other major events we've had over the last years is that, as you said, the roots and the connections inside any infrastructure network are just so extensive. But your example of the phone is a really apt metaphor because, you know, we all have a phone and we just simply forget about the fact it's always listening to us and it's always tracking our motions. I do remember a time myself when mobile phones were still a new thing and people said, no, nobody needs mobile phones. And besides which, what if they were to track us? And here we are, isn't so much necessarily the Orwellian idea of the government tracking people, just simply the fact that this data is there and these extremely dedicated, persistent threat actors are able to burrow in until they find it. Mm-hmm. So given that, and given that we've got this neglected orphan child called infrastructure, what could you recommend? Again, is it about funding? Is it about training? How can we help infrastructure tighten itself up a little bit more above and beyond what the legislators themselves have been proposing?
Well, that's a good one. And, you know, there's so many different maybe forces at play here in that people who provide networking and bandwidth and whatever, they are basically comped on providing that availability and connectivity, right? And because that's the incentive, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be, because that's the incentive, that's what they're really trying to get at. And so whenever people have talked about, hey, let's put some security controls in here, et cetera, there's always been pushback about, hey, we don't want to do that. Even if it was something as simple as what we call DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service attacks, you know, there's certain best practices out there that says, hey, if a packet is coming from your network, but the source address is not in your network, you shouldn't let that out. You shouldn't let that out because it's clearly a spoofed packet, right? But it's only until recently that that best practice has actually been enforced. And that's very rudimentary stuff. The idea that we could get to some place where everyone's privacy was preserved is so far away. I just can't see that happening. So say for your average citizen, people still struggle with connectivity. They just do, right? I travel all the time and it kills me that half of the time I'm trying to get on a call from airplane Wi-Fi and I can't get on. And these are big problems to solve. And I think for the average person who doesn't think about cybersecurity, they could have 100 problems. This isn't one of them.
Obviously, one of the big things that has become an elephant in the room over the last year or so is AI. I mean, AI has been around for decades, but with generative AI, all of a sudden, everybody has discovered it. And it's becoming the cornerstone of pretty much every activity. And, you know, some are greeting this with enthusiasm, some with greater reservations, some companies leaping in too quickly, perhaps. And this seems to ride the Gartner hype cycle, which is something I know you are very familiar with. So where do you see AI going in the next 12 months, especially riding the hype cycle?
Yeah. And if for the listeners, if you're familiar with the hype cycle, right, it's that sort of swooshy curve that moves up and then way down, right? And the up is the peak of inflated expectations, I think it's called. The down is the trough of disillusionment, and then it kind of rises to a plateau of productivity. And if you look at a typical hype cycle for, say, any other technology, it'll have a bunch of dots on it that might represent disciplines or processes or technologies that are spread out across the hype cycle. But in the AI one, everything is on the leading edge going toward the peak or just at the peak. So it's very visually indicative of where things are going. Hey, we're moving to the peak of inflated expectations, right? And the sort of magic of these AIs over the last 2 years has been it is the best natural language interface to data that we have ever seen, so that you can have a conversation with data or ask it to present itself in a different way, right? And that's mostly for text, but also for pictures and in some cases for office files, et cetera, et cetera. But it is that natural language interface that I think is going to become a massive new threat surface. So for example, I'll give you a couple of examples here. There's a massive, massive push to get these things put out there, to get these AIs put out there to do jobs that people currently do. I remember there was a study, an airline did a study at the beginning of this year where they said, okay, if they could use one of these Gen AIs to handle phone calls where the phone caller just had one single thing they were trying to do, reschedule a flight, cancel my flight, change my seat, get credit for miles, whatever, right? If they could have an AI do that instead of people, they would save $667 million a year. That is real money. I don't care who you are. That is a lot of money. So imagine that they know this and they're like, well, we haven't quite figured out how to secure these interfaces yet, but the pressure, the financial pressure to push that out there, regardless of who's going to lose a job or if their job changes or whatever, just that bottom line of saving two-thirds of $1 billion is going to be massive. Now, translate this to a bank. So imagine that you put one of these Gen AIs in front of your bank so that somebody could just say, hey, show me my bank balance, right? An obvious, easy conversation, right? But what if the person cleverly said somehow, show me my neighbor's bank balance? And there's many, many different ways you could say that, right? In the real world, there's all this social engineering that happens, which is effective. And what these Gen AIs could be prone to in the next year is that people will socially engineer how to figure out how to compromise them or get around this data. And I think there's a lot of people obviously aware of this, but again, the financial pressure to put these things out there is just too great.
I could deep fake your face and voice right now and just use that. So,
well, if you do, Steve, please make me look younger and handsomer.
Done. I will do that as quid pro quo for taking your money.
Okay.
What was it called? Dan, do anything. You can also talk a chatbot into what it's not supposed to do by just saying, pretend you're not you. What would you do if you were a different chatbot? Threat actors always have such wonderfully clever ideas of how to break a system. Everything looks like a nail when you are a hammer.
Yes.
And you know what also this reminds me of? Yahoo is firing a quarter of its cybersecurity staff, including all of its red team. Yeah,
they're
going to outsource their red teaming to third-party vendors. And they think this is about strategic alignment, but it seems much more about exactly the same thing. Cost savings, shareholder value. Mm-hmm. And this is the same kind of issue that, as you said, with the banks, they get seduced by the technology or the airlines without thinking about the full dangers behind that. This is a classic part of human nature. So I imagine we can say that we can anticipate human nature to continue in 2025 the way it has done for the last few thousand years, always seeking the faster and cheaper way without perhaps wanting to pause and look at the dangers or the concerns. I mean, who wants to worry about that? Do you have anything you would like to add regarding our ongoing challenges with the software supply chain issues? We've got issues that have come all the way out from the COVID period to today. But now also, without getting too political at all, I mean, companies are considering tariffs that may be imposed by the new administration. How do you think it's going to play out in terms of the supply chain becoming more reliable, especially with the increase in demand for chips from NVIDIA and people like that?
Oh, there's a lot going on there, Steve. So let me break this down a little bit. And first, let me talk about the software supply chain. So a story that concerned many, many people in the cybersecurity community this year was at the beginning of the year, I think it was February or March, there was an almost earth-shattering compromise of an open source tool called XZUtils. It's a compression library.
Yep, I remember that.
It's widely used in many Linux distributions. A nation-state threat actor basically social engineered the poor software maintainer of that software to basically give them access and let them take over the project, right? And I'm quite familiar with open source, and there's many great things about it, and practically the whole internet is built on it today. But in this particular case, they then spent months afterwards, well, it took them months to get the social engineering done, and then they spent months creating a very sneaky backdoor, which, had it made it to all the distributions out there, would have given that nation state actor access to millions of Linux hosts on the internet. And again, they would have been in an even better position than the Salt Typhoon actor in that they could install further backdoors and look at anything, actually look at data run SQL queries, et cetera, et cetera. It would have been a total nightmare. We were only saved because another individual, some network admin somewhere, happened to notice that his SSH sessions were taking a half second longer to complete. And so he dug down into it, found the back door, raised the alarm, basically saved the world. Somebody should send that guy a gift basket if they haven't already. But when this news came out, imagine all the other nation state threat actors in the world, you know, there's maybe six of them, who are now like, oh, that's possible? Well, why don't we launch operations against 50 or 100 open source packages? And what if they're just successful 1% of the time or 2% of the time, and they get two or three packages compromised with backdoors? And then it very well could be, if we have the same conversation a year from now, Steve, then we will be talking about, well, yeah, there was that that massive backdoor, and now everybody does have to use end-to-end encryption because nobody can trust anything.
These threat actors are very good at modifying their business models. They are highly adaptable and agile. I think they're great case studies to study from in a business school, actually, because of the way they can address and pivot so quickly. On the other side of that, we do see the occasional victory for the so-called good guys, where they take down somebody like Lockbit. Some of these big names, whether it's groups or the applications they work with, they're taken down by federal law enforcement. However, they keep popping up as new ones. And so when you trace back the malware being used by a new startup, you can see that the roots of it are basically from a previous one, from Lockbit or Babok or something like that. So in terms of the new year, I think it's a fait accompli to say we're going to still see a wide range of both nation state actors and APTs and just highly sophisticated gangs. But have you noticed any particular shifts in their expertise areas? Again, moving from smash and grabs to, you know, penetrating and lurking or sabotage. Have you seen any sort of trends amongst the more sophisticated groups that we may want to look for next year?
Probably the biggest trend I've seen over the last couple of years, and a lot of this comes back to, I was an analyst at Forrester. And part of that job, I was an analyst at Forrester up until this summer, and part of that job is taking calls from end user clients who may be struggling with an issue, and they're like, hey, I'm thinking of adopting this particular technology. Can you tell me, like, who are the good vendors in that space? Or what does it look like if you deploy that? Who do I need to get involved, stakeholders, et cetera? And a lot of these, without going into the details of the technologies, sometimes I would ask, like, yeah, what's driving this? Why are you asking this now? And they'd be, you know, they might admit, well, we got hit by ransomware last year, and we're trying to close the barn door after the horse has escaped. But what, you know, what else can you do? And ransomware was the best, say, implementation of monetizing threat activity that we'd ever seen, right? So there'd been hacking and exfiltration. People hack in, grab a bunch of data, and then maybe what do they do with it, right? Who wants to buy it? They got to go find a buyer and all this stuff, and then take a discount, and et cetera, et cetera. But with ransomware, it was really just you can hack in there, run some scripts, encrypt everything, and then sit back and wait for a big check, right? Or a bunch of Bitcoin. So a lot of attacks that we had seen, say a lot of activity that we had seen previously, where there might have been an extortion or a DDoS attack or whatever, those all switched to ransomware because it was much higher return for the attacker. I haven't seen anything since that has pivoted from that. So say for maybe the last 3-4 years. And I suppose something could happen, but the defenders are starting to get better. And the ones who didn't pay and basically spent months rebuilding all their systems, those systems are much more resilient now and good for them, right? But unfortunately, this is just this long fight that everybody has to do. And I feel so much sympathy for the defenders, right? Because they're fighting with these shadowy people and trying to protect their data. And it's just they can't all just take Christmas break because the attackers know staffing's going to be down as people are out. Let's launch our attack Christmas Eve.
Absolutely. Any of those holidays, Christmas Eve, Thanksgiving Day in the US, even Super Bowl Sunday. I mean, yeah, those are sitting ducks. Mm-hmm. It reminds me, I think if you were to ask me what my biggest story of 2024 would be, I'd say it was CDK, which was the software firm that manages car dealerships across the US. So pretty much every dealer does their leases and financial deals through CDK. And they ended up paying $25 million to the ransomware group. Because they saw that they had lost $600 million in the, I think, the 4 weeks following the attack. So as a cost of doing business, it's small potatoes to just simply pay this, expecting that there's honor among thieves to restore the information. Mm-hmm. But I also noticed that libraries are a big target for ransomware threat actors. You think, well, why libraries? They're not exactly a for-profit organization. They're not. But they pay. They pay up quickly because they are funded and subsidized by their city or local area, but they are very quick to pay up. And to me, that shows the kind of astute business awareness. It isn't just simply a matter of looking at the biggest brand names and attacking them, but saying, who's got the biggest ROI for our efforts as a threat actor? Yes, hospitals, certainly, but also libraries and other small towns, little tiny towns, will quickly pay up because they have no resources to fight this.
Yeah. Yeah. And thanks for reminding me about that. I was going to bring this up, but I forgot to mention until you did that there was a whole wave of attacks against hospitals a few years ago.
Yeah, oh, yes.
And what I've been seeing lately is a lot of the activity around acquiring new technology and deploying it properly and having bigger cybersecurity budgets has been in the healthcare community, right? They're very, very sensitive to this now. And I think they had to pay up because
absolutely,
they can't, you know, there's people sitting there on life support, right? And those systems need to stay working. And there was a huge gap there where they had been pretty lax. I mean, not throwing shade on anybody. It just wasn't necessarily a super big priority for them, probably because they didn't have a bunch of financial data to steal. But I guess the good news in all of this, and this is a cycle you just keep seeing over time, is now they're getting better, and it might be soon that they're better than the average, right? And good for them. You know, you had said something earlier where it reminded me of a phrase that I use to describe life, and that is times change, but people don't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just gets back to human nature and all of the foibles that the Greeks witnessed and wrote great plays about. All of that still applies today. Times change, but people don't.
Of course, we're not advocating the payment of ransoms. Oh, for sure. When you have to physically run from wing to wing in a hospital to go and get an x-ray because everything is down, or worse than that, if you don't realize that dialysis pumps and other things have been altered to deliver in a sort of James Bond style, deliver that poison pill invisibly, this becomes, again, that insidious concept that people don't want to think about. Now, one of the things that I would be interested in seeing in the new year myself, I'm interviewing myself here, organizations getting more in touch with breach coaches. These large consulting firms do this to provide breach coach services, which is a professional emergency specialist on call. Don't start doing anything until you talk to this. It's not like talking to your lawyer. It's talking to the person who knows how to deploy the appropriate emergency steps. I'm wondering whether that might become more of an interesting line of business for consulting firms to offer, given that you have to have a specialist to step in to guide you, not only for what to do, but what not to do when you are in that moment of crisis. Yeah. So perhaps that's something.
I did not know it had a name. I didn't know it had a name, the breach coach.
Yeah.
I have been through several, what you might call tabletop exercises with clients over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And you only have to go through one of those before you realize how much you didn't know and how much, if you are working with somebody who's been through a breach before, they have hopefully already seen all of the ways that this can go wrong and steer you in the right way. So, well, good for them for offering that service, because imagine a poor library administrator, they are not going to know that, hey, at the end of this, all the data might leak anyway.
And you might find also that your insurance company is going to be far happier to play along with you if you have a breach coach on staff or on call, in terms of mitigating risk in advance of an event, but also in terms of dealing with the risk after it happens. So perhaps that's a thing that people are going to discover more of. Tabletops as well, very, very good. But we also always have that issue that people don't have the time to do them, so they never do them correctly.
Yeah.
Just in terms of a couple other things, one thing I did want to look at is we've been talking about threat actors, again, being the key threat to a lot of things. But a lot of times the problems are internal, not just simply the lack of commitment to preparation, but just simply bad management. One of the stories from this last couple of years has been Sellafield, the huge nuclear plant, or now, I guess, passive as a plant, but a storage area of plutonium in the UK, which really got into some hot water for the fact that the safety reports and the due diligence that was supposed to happen didn't happen. They admitted in their own words that they failed to meet their own standards of security, and they were very sorry. This, again, seems to be a typical approach to internal weakness that external threat actors can fully take advantage of. But this becomes some sort of must-have to pull up our socks, perhaps, in terms of the complacency that management may have for procedure. Even if they are fully aware of the dangers, the cost or the effort just doesn't seem right, and we can just sort of kick it under the rug and nobody will see. Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate that organizations will collectively recognize that they have an internal responsibility to keep their own house in order as a key part of data security of any sort?
Yes and no. Obviously, in an ideal world, people would recognize the importance of what these regulations and compliance regimes are all about and then do the right thing. But you don't even have to look at, say, cybersecurity. You look at any other thing like financials to see, oh, a company will take itself all the way to the end, lying to everybody, and then it will become uncovered that they – I'm not saying Sellafield lied. I'm just saying that there have been examples of companies, one I'm thinking of in the United States, Enron, who basically fudged their books to the point where at the very end, the entire company collapsed. So many of the employees were left destitute. I believe the CEO and CFO went to jail, and one of them committed suicide. One went to jail, died in jail. It is for reasons like that we have this third-party auditor function, right? Because you can't always trust that everybody in the industry will, quote, internally do what's right. And so that's just one of those things that just has to happen. And I'm not saying we need more big government or whatever, but auditing is a thing. Prepare for your audit and just treat that. You know, I know it's sometimes in cyber, we joke about how the auditor is, they are their own threat actor, but it doesn't have to be that way. If you're doing the right thing, if everyone's doing the right thing, if you're cutting corners on stuff that you shouldn't be cutting corners on, that's a bad business practice. There's no getting around that.
Good. Yeah. So the threat of the auditor at the door, that's a really great motivator. Now, we are getting close to the conclusion here, and I've really enjoyed chatting with you.
I could talk to you all day, Steve.
Quantum computing, it seems to be a big thing. We've got large organizations now establishing their PQC priorities. We've covered that in episodes here on the podcast already, but it seems to be getting closer and closer on the horizon. Some people will say it is already here. So what's your perspective on quantum computing and its horizon for 2025?
The threat here is if somebody were to build a quantum computer of sufficient power that they could then break all of the asymmetric encryption that we all use today. So when that happens, the world will change in that, again, in that we won't be able to trust anything. And you had asked a question like, are we getting closer to that? Has it already happened? We probably won't know when it happens because the organization that probably builds one of these is going to be a nation state actor who is going to then use it to then decrypt all of their opponent's traffic and get secrets and then compromise people. So we won't actually know. I have seen incremental progress, but it still looks like we are years and years away. And that's good news, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I was at, I want to think it was Black Hat, like 5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago at least. And there was a quantum computing researcher who, like, this is his job. And he said, I swear up and down within 2 years, there will be a quantum computer that breaks this stuff. Now, either he was wrong or he was right and somebody's built it, but is not telling anybody. Let's assume that he's wrong for the moment. That means we still have a little bit of time to get our house in order. And so there is efforts at NIST to come up with algorithms that we can all use that are safe against quantum. And I believe that in this year, 2025, you will start to see companies starting to roll these out. Some early ciphers have already been rolled out in sort of test and experimentation. And some of these have fallen very, very quickly from good guy researchers who were like, oh, you know, if you do it this way, you could do some sort of differential analysis on it and it breaks. So the good news for most people is that it looks like we still have some time and we're getting very close to the point where we might be able to start replacing all these ciphers. And for the average Joe, no one's going to have to do anything, right? Your vendors will swap in new protocols and it's all going to be good because we've had to do stuff like this before with hash algorithms like MD5 or encryption algorithms like RC4, where attacks accelerated to the point where we're like, oh, we better replace this right now. So we're actually getting pretty good at that. So I am hoping that by the time 2025 ends, we'll start to see the rollout of some of these quantum safe protocols. And then this will be one of those things like the Y2K where people did the right preparation and then it turned out to be a nothing burger.
I was just reviewing my notes here. I mean, AWS has their PQC migration plan already in place. Google does as well. So all the big players are indeed well on board with this. What I love what you said is it might have already happened. Or a threat actor's already got this under control and is using it. So good stuff to contemplate for 2025 with regards to quantum. A couple other things we could be talking about here in terms of diversity. If we look at the human side of work, but again, we had a great episode talking about DEI in cybersecurity. Are we still suffering a skills gap? It's ironic to see companies like Yahoo laying people off, but are we still suffering a skills gap and a gap in diversity in the security business in the companies that you're familiar with?
I think it's yes and yes, yes to all of those. My sort of riff on this one is something I've been thinking about a lot. My father passed away just a couple of years ago, and right at the end there, he was obsessed with these visualizations called population pyramids. And he used to talk about how in all the civilizations up to now, there's always been a lot more young people than old people. But that is inverting now. And its birth rates just plummet all around the world. And no one's quite figured this out. In the sense of what's causing that, how big of a problem is it? Is it a problem forever? What's going to happen? But I've been looking around as I go to like cybersecurity conferences or meet with clients and partners and whatever. And then, you know, everyone's my age, right? We all have gray hair. And I'm like, where are the young people? And I was talking with the network vendor CTO, great guy. And he said, David, we can't find any young sales engineers. He said, the average age of our sales engineer is 53. And that's about my age. And I'm like, well, they're all going to retire here real soon. That's the average. That means half of them are older than that. It just seems like yesterday that all the SEs were like, you know, early 30s. And if this is happening in all of the, if it's not just cyber, but it's all the industries around the world, and you hear about this, right? You hear about, oh, well, this manufacturing process is, it's basically pinned on one guy who's 57, right? He knows it and he keeps this whole thing running, but he's going to retire soon. We have nobody to replace him. If that happens in every industry at the same time, what's the fix? There's no fix, right? And I think this could be a boon for diversity in the fact that people will stop thinking, oh, we have too many people to hire from. We need to hire the right mix. It will become this desperate scramble for we will take anybody. We will take anybody of any background at all if they can do this particular job. But I think worldwide, we're going to see all of these problems where there's just not enough, say, skilled labor, which has already been a problem, right? Which is what we have sort of been talking about.
So as our population of qualified professionals continues to flounder, what about passkeys? Passkeys, to me, seem to be a more attractive concept than passwords, and even authenticators that pump out these little six-digit codes can bypass now. So MFA and passwords, I don't know if they are a stopgap measure, but do you foresee passkey technology being more embraced in 2025? Are people comfortable with it? Will it become a thing next year?
I certainly hope so. The passkeys and the FIDO and all of that stuff, it's fantastic because it reduces the friction of doing the thing that you had to do anyway, right? So if you can skip an MFA and or skip entering a password or changing a password or all of the stuff that good people have to do these things because there are bad people out there, right? If you think about it, it's just like a tax on good people, people trying to do the right thing. And this exists in security systems all over the world, right? I have to do what? I have to do, why do I have to do this? Oh, because there's bad people who could take advantage of that, right? That has made it so that my mother cannot ever even get onto a computer on her bank. She can never remember her password, and so she'll enter the wrong password too many times and it locks her out.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so then she has to get on the phone and call. And so I tried to help her with this many, many times. But passkeys could re-enable her to join the digital world again in the sense that it represents a digital thing that you have that can't be compromised. Now, the only wrinkle in this that's happening right now is that the big providers, Microsoft, Google, Apple, they would like to have the passkey be part of your identity, not necessarily tied to your device, which makes sense because, like, suppose you use the website on your Mac to generate the passkey for your bank, right? Then later you go on your phone and you're traveling around. You need to check your balance or transfer some money, or you just have your phone with you. The passkey exists, right? Apple just kind of silently moves it over to your phone. However, this kind of breaks a lot of stuff on the back end as to how these things are supposed to work. And so there's a bit of tension going on in the cyber community right now about, hey, the ecosystem providers, are making it easier and easier for the actual end user consumer, but possibly complicating the ultimate promise of passkeys. And I don't necessarily have an opinion on it. I see it both ways, and I've already been saved by that fact because I was doing exactly the thing I was just talking about. But either way, how it shakes out, I think these passkeys are going to be much better. And I hope that they get adopted more and more and more, and that we don't find out that it turns out to be just another threat surface.
We had Andrew Chikiar from FIDO Alliance on an episode a couple of months back, as well as Pedro Martinez from Talos. And they were both very, very bullish on it. They just said, you know, it's already here. It's working really well. There's a huge uptake. So they were very positive as well. I love what you said there about passwords being a tax on good people. I mean, what an excellent turn of phrase. And I, too, have an 82-year-old mother who can't get into her bank for those reasons. So I think there's great possibility for it to be much more embraced just passively.
Right.
Again, I always tell people, if you already unlock your phone with your face, you're already using passkey technology, basically. It's just a matter of not thinking about it.
Yeah.
I think we should probably just jump to if you have anything in terms of a closing prediction for the year. I don't want to put you under pressure, but what should people watch out for? What's interesting to you or what's scary to you?
Oh, let me think for just a minute.
I'll tell you what mine is, if you want.
Oh, yeah, please do.
One word. Chaos. I think that the chaos of the political transition of the new year is going to be such a huge distraction, not only in the US. I think you'll find that chaos will be the greatest tool for threat actors because you can do so much inside it, right? It's like the old curse. May you live in interesting times because you're too distracted keeping your head above water to notice what's going on. So that would be my thing. What would be yours?
My response to that is is an agreement. And I heard a phrase recently. It was that history moves faster than a human life. And you can see this all the time as an older person says something like, you know, I just don't understand the world anymore. In my day, you know, things cost 5 cents or people had this role and they didn't do that. And I had learned through looking at history that people have always felt this way, right? Yeah, there might be some long period of time where nothing really changes, like the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, et cetera, et cetera. But then when things really start cooking, it goes so fast that you can barely, like just in my lifetime, which is post-World War II, we saw the rise of China to being such an amazing powerhouse, and we can never seem to decide, are they friends or enemies or what? All of these things, and even when there's not like a major world war going on, that like World War I or World War II, which obviously one could see like that's going to disrupt everything. So even though we've had this sort of Pax Americana for 70 years now, the world still changes so fast that people get constantly left behind, scratching their heads. Like, I used to be a CAD designer, but that whole business went away or it's all become automated. If 2025 is defined as chaos, I don't think it's necessarily going to be a new thing, Steve. Like, that's just our natural, that's just human nature, is that we're always striving for something or striving for more, and that it ends up causing a sort of unstable landscapes that we as generations have to walk along, hopefully our whole lives, and we can walk along that successfully and then leave it to the next generation to do their walk. At least it's not boring.
So I say chaos and you're saying this is how things are and we always struggle with change. But my goodness, David, this has been amazing. I want to really genuinely thank you for your participation because this has been such fun. Thank you so much, David, for being here on the Talos Security Sessions podcast.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Anytime.
Remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and tell a friend or a colleague or a client or all of them about the Talos Security Sessions podcast. And join the conversation on LinkedIn. Just search for Talos Cloud Security and watch for our podcast posts. We have had a wonderful year with fabulous guests discussing data sovereignty, post-quantum computing, passkeys, powering the cloud, and so much more. And they are all available to you by subscribing to the Talos Security Sessions podcast on your platform of choice. And we will be back again next year with more episodes and more discussions on the topics you need to know about to successfully carry on in the business of information security. Until then, I'm Steve Prentice. Thanks for listening.